Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Dr. James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute, who examines growing Israeli anger at Prime Minister Netanyahu for obstructing a Gaza ceasefire after 6 hostages were killed, and U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris's stand on Israel's brutal war. Ethan Wright, an activist with the group Climate Defiance, who talks about blocking the road leading to the Federal Reserve's annual Wyoming Symposium to protest Fed Chair Jerome Powell's role in the climate crisis. And Nora Benavides of the media democracy group Free Press, who discusses a new coalition's call on news media to uncompromisingly report on the threats to democracy during the 2024 U.S. election campaign. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In late August, the U.S. Treasury Department announced it was imposing sanctions on former Haitian President Michel Martelly, a former U.S. ally who led the Caribbean nation after its devastating 2010 earthquake. Martelly is accused of involvement in cocaine trafficking and sponsoring Haitian gangs, who now run much of the capital city, Port-au-Prince. Foreign Policy magazine reports that U.S. sanctions were imposed as Martelly was considering launching a political comeback that threatened Haiti's fragile Washington-backed transitional government. Martelly has been charged with corruption in both U.S. and Haitian courts. However, the U.S. charges were dropped after several witnesses were afraid to testify. In Haiti, a judge had issued an arrest warrant for Martelly in January, but that has not been carried out. In 2010, Washington had urged Haitian authorities to remove a rival candidate from the election ballot that brought Martelly to power, allocated hundreds of millions of dollars to his government for post-earthquake reconstruction projects, and supported his hand-picked successor, Jovenel Moïse, who was assassinated in 2021, which accelerated Haiti's descent into violence and chaos. 3 years ago, the city of Austin, Texas, banned homeless encampments in the city's downtown, which resulted in years of conflict between advocates for the homeless and downtown business interests and right-wing activists. In These Times reports that the conflict served as a launching pad for pro-Trump tech billionaire Joe Lonsdale, whose libertarian think tank, the Cicero Institute, helped transform homelessness policing from a niche issue into a rallying cry in the Republican culture war. Earlier this year, the Institute filed an amicus brief before the U.S. Supreme Court in a case where conservative justices later ruled that cities now have the power to clear out homeless tent cities regardless of whether alternative shelter is available. Now, 8 Republican-led states have passed repressive laws modeled by the Cicero Institute that criminalize the unhoused. Trump's vice presidential running mate, J.D. Vance, repeated Institute talking points at a Senate hearing last year, which call for homeless repeat offenders of camping bans to be fined up to $5,000. Advocates say these draconian measures are part of an effort to defund long-term solutions to skyrocketing rents, the shortage of affordable housing, and inadequate funding for mental health and addiction treatment. The great social movements of the 20th century for labor and civil rights were largely self-funded. These movements did not rely on foundations or government agencies for their budgets. However, today, many progressive organizations rely on foundations and wealthy donors to operate, making them vulnerable to defunding under right-wing governments, which would certainly occur in a second Trump administration. Many progressive activist groups now operate under a tax-exempt 501c3 status where donations are tax-deductible, but political organizing is restricted, and a separate 501c4 designation where contributions are not tax-deductible, but more partisan political activity is permitted. But the American Prospect reports that the Internal Revenue Service has never fully clarified what kinds of political activities are and are not permitted. A future Trump or other right-wing administration could weaponize the IRS and change the rules, intimidating foundation funding for progressive groups. The fundamental problem is that the liberal left today is more reliant on foundation support than the right. 50 years of foundation funding of right-wing think tanks has been invested in programs to enlist individual donors with nothing comparable among liberal think tanks. The article concludes that the only effective defense is for progressives to go back to their roots and build genuine mass membership groups. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Israel's brutal war in Gaza has killed more than 40,000 Palestinians since the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack that killed 1,200 Israelis and kidnapped 250 hostages. After months of negotiations to hammer out a deal to release the hostages failed, the Israeli military reported on August 31st that they had found 6 hostages that had been killed by their Hamas guards. The tragic deaths of these young hostages, one of them an American citizen, provoked massive protests and a general strike by Israelis, who blame Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for his refusal to sign any ceasefire agreement to facilitate the release of the remaining hostages and end the slaughter in Gaza. During the Democratic Party convention in Chicago, Palestinian Americans and their supporters didn't succeed in their attempt to schedule a speaker to address the convention and the nation about the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. But some of the activists involved in that effort were pleased that growing opposition to U.S. weapons transfers and full support of Israel's Gaza war received widespread media attention. Your reporter spoke with James Zogby, co-founder and president of the Arab American Institute, who was among those delegates in Chicago demanding a speaker to address the war in Gaza. Here he assesses growing Israeli anger at Netanyahu for blocking a ceasefire, U.S. policy toward Israel, and whether or not Vice President Kamala Harris is signaling a break from President Biden's unconditional support for Israel. He begins by assessing the effectiveness of public pressure on Netanyahu to change his Gaza war policy.
So far, he's resisted public opinion. Look, for several months since before the war began, but certainly since the war began, his numbers have been very low. And all the polls show that if there were an election, his party would be swept out of power, which is why he so desperately hangs on to power and knows that if he does sign any agreement, he loses the support of a number of parties in his coalition. He might pick up others, but he's not interested in that because ideologically, he is part of this extreme right-wing government and not just captive of it, as some say. So he's dealt with the fact that he's not supported by the Israeli public, but he does have control of the reins of government, and he's not willing to let go. So I don't see the demonstrations as moving him. What would move him is if President Biden were to take some dramatic step like suspending arms shipments as the British did today, or some other action that would send a very clear message to Israel that he can no longer count on U.S. support. That would be the decisive thing.
Over the last week or two, we've heard about the emergence of polio in Gaza, a threat to children and everyone, and there's the 2.3 million residents of Gaza. In recent days, there's been some agreement for a truce in several areas of Gaza to allow health workers to administer polio vaccines to Palestinian children. It seems that the only thing that likely moved Israel to cooperate in this effort, when they've been disallowing food and medical supplies and destroying water and sanitation infrastructure, is the threat of the spread of polio, this deadly disease, to Israel itself.
That is the case, yes, and deeply troubling at that. There has not been any demonstrable concern for Palestinian suffering, Palestinian fate in all of this. And it's something that has really gripped me, and I think many others, that there is a genocide unfolding. We know it. We get the reports daily. I've spoken with doctors who've been there from several different countries and have told harrowing stories, spoken to human rights groups and individuals on the ground who are seeing it play out every day. It is just amazing. I remember going through the 1982 Israeli invasion of Beirut. I thought that was bad. This is much worse. I'm hearing stories of things I can't even imagine, how people get over it.
James, there's been much speculation about Vice President Kamala Harris and her position on U.S. policy towards Israel and its war in Gaza. In your recent editorial, you expressed some optimism that the vice president has a more empathetic view towards Palestine and Palestinians than does President Biden. I wondered if you could explain the signs you see that if she is elected president, she may depart from this long litany of steadfast support for Israel with very little consideration given to Palestinians and their right to self-determination.
I can't predict. I have no crystal ball to look in. But what I can say is that I had a conversation with her. I've seen the things, heard the things she said, watched how she's operated, and feel that clearly there's a difference between her and the president. And I don't want to ignore that. I don't think anyone should not pay attention to the fact that nobody has ever spoken about Palestine before at a convention. I don't want to ignore the fact that she has spoken about self-determination, something that no president has ever done before. And I do think that, that she has the capacity to break free. Will she is still to be determined, but I'm feeling better about it than I felt about the last couple of presidential candidates that we've had on the Democratic side, better than Hillary Clinton and better than Joe Biden.
That was Dr. James Zogby, co-founder and president of the Arab American Institute. Find more analysis and commentary on Israel's catastrophic war in Gaza by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On August 23rd, four members of the youth-led group Climate Defiance locked their arms together and blocked the driveway leading to the Federal Reserve Symposium in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. This is the world's preeminent gathering of central bankers, where the chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, delivers his annual address. The Fed's job is to maintain the health of the U.S. financial system, but Climate Defiance calls Powell a climate criminal for not reining in financial support for the fossil fuel industry. The four activists engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience were threatened with death, choked, and otherwise abused. After blocking the entrance for about an hour, they were arrested and held in jail for 36 hours, and now face four misdemeanor charges. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with one of the four, Ethan Wright, about his experience and why he risked arrest in Wyoming, one of the nation's most conservative states. He's been most active with the New York City-based group Planet Over Profit that's engaged in nonviolent direct action at the Summer of Heat protest campaign on Wall Street, targeting Citibank as the leading investor in new fossil fuel development since the 2015 Paris Climate Accords.
We were in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. We were there because Jerome Powell gives his yearly keynote speech at this economic symposium, which a lot of like federal regulators and world economists and stuff attend this conference. And he gives this keynote speech basically about the future of the world's economy. Jerome Powell is in a very powerful position where, if he wanted to, he could end fossil fuels literally tomorrow. He could end the funding of fossil fuels. So we were there to disrupt his speech.
Let me
And
stop you for a second. How could he do that? How could he end fossil fuels tomorrow?
he's the chair of the Federal Reserve. He has a lot of power in terms of federal regulations and stuff.
So he could just determine that funding fossil fuels was too risky a procedure for banks to undertake. Is that what you mean?
That kind of thing. Exactly. So we were there to interrupt his speech. To do that, we decided to put ourselves in lock boxes along the driveway to it was the Jackson Hole Lodge, which is this like fancy lodge where he was giving his speech at. And we blocked the driveway to that. We blocked it for about an hour before police ended up arresting us.
And I'm just going to explain for, because this is radio, when you said you were in lock boxes. So I saw a photo of you. You were spread across the road, four young people. You had your arms in these tubes, right? These lock boxes. And that's how you were able to block the road. So what happened after you were there for an hour and there was a pile up and the police came?
Well, I think it was the second cop car to pull up, but they came from behind us because they were assigned to the symposium and everything. We had like cones a good 50 feet away from us to kind of help slow traffic so that we weren't in danger by of getting hit by any cars and stuff. But yeah, the second cop car drove straight through those cones and stopped. It was like 2 feet away from us. And we were talking about this later on while we were in jail, but we were like, oh yeah, we were just weren't gonna move. We were just gonna be like, yeah, I guess this is where we're gonna get hit by a car, I guess. Because we really thought he was driving at the speed that we thought we were gonna get hit by him. And he kind of slammed on his brakes to stop like 2 feet behind us. This one officer, actually it was two officers. One officer got out and he was a very aggressive officer, I'd say. But this officer attempted to drag me off the road. He had like this weird grip on me where he was choking me. So that was very interesting. He was unable to, after about half an hour or so, there ended up being about 15 or so officers there. They decided to then pick us all up at the same time since we were attached to each other and drag us off of the driveway.
I can't remember who said this, but some promoter of nonviolent direct action said that those of us who, believe in peace should be as willing to take risks for what we believe in as soldiers do in a war. Like we have to be very committed and dedicated. And it seems like, there are definitely risks involved, physical risks. You're a young person, so I don't know what this means for your future if there might be a problem in the future getting jobs, or you're risking a lot. So why do you do it?
I do it because I have the ability to, and I want to see. I have six little brothers, and I want to see a future that they can grow up in and live and love the world in. And right now, we're not gonna have that. And that makes me sad and angry and so many emotions that I can't just sit by and do nothing about it.
That was Ethan Wright, one of four activists with the group Climate Defiance, who blocked the entrance to the Federal Reserve Symposium in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Learn more about Climate Defiance and its civil disobedience protest campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As former President Donald Trump, a twice impeached, four-time indicted convicted felon, liable for sexual assault who incited a coup attempt, campaigns for re-election in 2024, he charges that any election result, other than victory, will be evidence of fraud and a rigged process. At the same time, 140 of Trump's former staffers contributed to the Heritage Foundation's 900-page Project 2025, an authoritarian blueprint for a second Trump administration, with plans to replace thousands of federal civil servants with loyalists, employing the military to crack down on dissent, and round up millions of migrants for mass deportation. Although it's evident that Trump's tyrannical agenda and his well-documented pathological lying poses an existential threat to U.S. democracy, America's corporate news media all too often softens or sidelines the reporting on this threat, concerned that they'll be accused of partisan coverage. But a coalition of more than three dozen civil rights, consumer rights, and journalism organizations, led by the media democracy group Free Press, are calling on news outlets to accurately and unapologetically report on the threats to democracy during the remainder of the 2024 U.S. election campaign. Your reporter spoke with Nora Benavides, Senior Counsel and Director of Digital Justice and Civil Rights with Free Press, who talks about the coalition's goals that includes recommending six practices the media should adhere to in their coverage of the election and during moments of crisis.
Well, you know, this coalition came together because in the wake of the assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump, some pundits and politicians made pretty big public calls for the media to refrain from covering Trump's views, mounting authoritarianism in the United States, and to sort of walk things back. The attitude was, let's cool it down, let's calm down, you know, lower the temperature on how media is covering threats to democracy. And this coalition came about because Free Press felt that that was a very dangerous request. The idea that news outlets should reject their own journalistic duty to acquiesce to other figures, and particularly to those that are trying to thwart people's engagement in our democracy. So we brought together over three dozen organizations, journalists, high-level individuals, you know, in the United States, to urge media executives and news outlets to do six things this election cycle. And mostly, I mean, what the big takeaway is here is we are in an era of manipulation. People don't have the same set of facts that others, loved ones, colleagues do. And the media has a very powerful role that can help shape our discourse, our conversation, our understanding of events of the day. And we urge media outlets to pledge that their news companies will take up that task. We're in these very contentious times, Scott, and we need what I call information integrity. We need people to protect and name things. So I'm happy to go through the things that we recommend. You know, we pulled the coalition together. We've been working with news outlets on the messaging, and we're going to be doing trainings throughout the fall with journalists and newsrooms on how to implement these demands.
Nora, I wondered if you would summarize some of the six best practices the media should adhere to during moments of crisis and threats to U.S. democracy, especially in this period of the U.S. election. And I know there's been a lot said about calling out disinformation, stopping of false equivalence and both sidesism. I'm sure a lot of that's covered in your 6 points here.
Yeah, it's hard to list out six things and make them sound exciting, but I'll really try.
Okay.
The first and most important, I think, issue is how journalists and newsrooms commit to naming authoritarian and autocratic rhetoric. There's really a trend right now to kind of brush off threats of, the effort to delegitimize our democratic process. That's not fun to cover. And so everyone makes light of it. We've seen Elon Musk make jokes about, you know, the rule of law and authoritarianism. That is no laughing matter. And so I think that journalists and newsrooms have to commit to naming, pointing out for audiences what this rhetoric looks like. This is the kind of rhetoric that dehumanizes minority groups. We are seeing this in the rhetoric around immigrants, rhetoric that would flout the rule of law. Like I've mentioned earlier, the sort of blasé comments from Trump that people would never have to vote again if he wins. That's a dangerous, dangerous comment. That's an example of how we need clear coverage around why that's dangerous. So first and foremost, that's, I would say, the number one place is that journalists and newsrooms have to really identify what that looks like. And then, of course, as you mentioned, you know, false claims are everywhere. False claims are, you know, about what the price of, you know, toilet paper looks like. And so we really need journalists who make sure to cross-check information, fact-check, double-check. And part of that is because it's really hard to walk back a lie for audiences once they hear it. You know, the more times a lie is repeated, even in casual references, the harder it is to debunk that lie. And so I think journalists need to name when something is a lie. Many in the media were reticent to do that, specifically around Donald Trump in 2015. You know, and they said, well, he refers to alternative facts, and these are opinions. I think that journalists have to be more rigorous, remind audiences that misinformation is real, that lies said by big influential figures have dangerous consequences. The third piece I would mention is how audiences think about the impact of the story. Headlines matter. Images in the links matter. The sources that journalists quote. It's sort of this odd note. It's like, if you can get an audience to look beyond just the headline or the lead, we need journalists who practice caution and care, carefully selecting what they cover, how they describe it. When a lie is even casually repeated and framed in ways that viewers then make their own assumptions, that itself can lead people to have incorrect assumptions about facts.
That was Nora Benavides, Senior Counsel and Director of Digital Justice and Civil Rights with the media democracy group Free Press. Learn more about the coalition working for uncompromising media coverage of the election campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, KMRE in Bellingham, Washington, the Progressive Voices Network nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.